Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, I find myself in Sandton in the Johannesburg area. We are at Avatar's offices, and we are joined by someone who's no stranger to the platform. That is Zibuzi Somkhwanazi, who is co-founder and CEO of Avatar Agency Group, and we're going to be having a chat about where their business is. At the moment, they recently won a huge piece of business. They are the biggest black-owned advertising agency in the country and the third largest independent advertising agency in South Africa. So, greetings once again.
Hi, Mudiwa. Great catching up again.
Maybe where we can start is advertising agency. We understand that piece. But when we say you guys are the third largest independent, right, how are we defining this?
Okay. So within the country, there's broadly two categories of agencies, right? So those are your globally owned agencies and your South African owned agencies. Right, so your South African-owned agencies would be your independent, and your globally owned, you know, would come from typically the US, the UK. You know, they're part of their global expansion, and they have offices here in the country. So because of that, when they come in, they've got what you call global alignment lines, where a brand, say it's an international brand, appoints you in the United States, but by having an office here, by default, you have a piece of that account, as an example, or whichever countries that they operate in, by default, they have those accounts. So that's your biggest distinguisher between your independents that have to work for everything, you know, and you're globally aligned that also need to do a bit of work, but you know, they benefit from their global holding companies.
Okay. So there's a lot, you know, that needs to be unpacked in the world of advertising. And I'm sure that we're going to come back to where you guys are sitting in the market time and time again throughout today's discussion. But I thought maybe a good place to start is a recent piece of business that you guys have won and have been doing. You can describe for us, because I know there's terms about this, where something began, where you guys are, and that's with Absa. My understanding is that you guys are, you know, helping to, I guess, position them or to reposition them in the market. Obviously, from the outside, we are keen to understand how did that come about, and what does it actually mean, you know, for a business such as yours? And also, is this a new relationship with Absa, or is this an extension of some of existing, you know, relationships? Because I understand that maybe you'll do a little piece of work there, another work there.
So maybe let me talk about the market. I think for any advertising business, you know, the clients to have is a big financial institution like a bank.
Yes.
And telecoms.
Literally about to say telco, yeah. Especially in this market.
In this market. Those are your biggest spenders. Yes, some of the FMCGs, but you know, there's multiple brands that sit in FMCG companies. And you typically have some of the brands, but with a bank, you have the entire basket, or with a telecoms business, you know, or cell phone company, you know, you'll have the entire basket. So it's very significant because Absa is part of the big four banks, right? And it's an incredibly large financial institution. If I'm not mistaken, they operate in about 12 countries, right? The reason why that is important for us as a business, and why they were important for us as a business, is one, we love doing work on the continent. We've done, you know, quite a lot in the past, but we want to do more and more, because the more we do that, is the closer we are to establishing a physical presence, but you need a client to go there with, you know. So when your work is seen across the continent, different parts of the continent, you know, that's very important for us, one. So, you know, the world of banking, about 2 years ago, so 2 or 3 years ago, we pitched for another Big Four bank and we didn't make it with that Big Four bank. But what happened was, you know, what was interesting, what happened afterwards, we sat down with the chief marketing officer of that Big Four bank and he said, look, we understand that we didn't get it. You know, let's understand, what did we get right? What did we get wrong? And he told us the whole process, what happened. We took all of those learnings, you know, to heart, and the opportunity came again now with APSA, because we had learned so much from the other pitch, right? We applied a whole lot of those learnings, you know, when we're invited. So they invited the whole town firstly, and then, you know, it was a shortlist and shortlist until we made it onto the shortlist. But our secret weapon was the fact that, you know, we had a go at another, you know, bank of similar size.
So you had to fail first before you succeeded.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it. You know, and we came in with those lessons. And our approach in this pitch is we got the South Africans across the world that we respect the most. So these are people who work in different markets, completely different markets. I mean, some were in Singapore, some were in Thailand, some were in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. These are previous clients who were CMOs and now working in global markets in different industries. And we formed a council with them, right, when we went about this piece of work, because we wanted to have a different lens on the work, because we tend to be biased in what we see every day as the norm. But we wanted someone who comes in with a different bias and gives us, you know, a different type of thinking. So this is what the advantage a global agency would typically have, right? And we knew that we were going up global agencies. We were the only independent on the list, and you know, also the only Black-owned business on the list, right? And so with that, we went into that pitch, you know. So we came in fresh. We had never done business with them, right? And we were told that we won in the end. We won that piece of business. And for us, what it means to us as a business, and you know, it now becomes our biggest client. You know, it's grown us significantly as a client. It's grown us significantly in revenues. But I think very importantly, no Black-owned business has ever had a Big Four bank ever in the history of the country, right? This is the first time that it has. And to grow to this scale, you know, as a group, is a first as well for the country. So we understand that what's happened here is that the glass ceiling has just been broken, right? Because the perception was, there aren't any businesses like us that can do what we can do. And we've just successfully launched the bank's positioning. And what's interesting now is that it's not a campaign. It's a positioning, and with a positioning, that's the bedrock that all your campaigns sit on for the next few years. So that is the most critical work you'll probably ever do with a big brand, is getting the positioning right. Because then everything internally, externally, it builds from that positioning. And to be trusted with that, right, is a big thing.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. And we're super proud of the team. We're super proud of the leadership shown by the APSA team, you know, led by the CEO, Ari, as well as Sydney from a CMO perspective, you know. And we're really proud of the work, you know, Your Story Matters. And you know, talking about a bit about the work, is, you know, it you know, where the gap was a bank that is human centric, right, that comes across as human. And you know, post-COVID, you know, consumers need a bit more empathy, you know, because consumers went through the most. And, you know, when you looked at, you know, the research, APSA could actually claim that space. So your story matters. You know, it was about, you know, it's not about the bank. It's about your story and what you want and the role of the bank in that story. It's not about what the bank wants, but what you want, you know, and how you writing your story. And it's the bank writing the story with you. And that's the bedrock, you know, in which now everything will now be built, you know, from branch experience, you know, right through to communication, how the bank shows up in activations, you know. So it's who the bank is, in essence. And to be part of defining that, oh my goodness.
So when it comes to something like your story matters, and how do you, obviously we're talking about human centricity, all that, how do you arrive there? Because obviously you've just spoken about the fact that you know, you wanted, you know, the human being at the center, all of that stuff. But I guess my question is, what is the process of arriving there? Because I'm pretty sure that to get there, there were many taglines.
Yeah.
There were many philosophies.
Yeah.
That were probably discarded along the way. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was interesting was the bank had already started on a process where they you know, so within the bank itself, there was restructuring that was going on. So before, marketing used to sit in different business units, right? And now there was a restructure in the bank where now marketing sat centrally in the bank, and they got a CMO, and that was Sydney Mbele. And part of that, part of the things that he started doing was going into a research process, like a co-building process with everyone in the bank, you know. And when I say everyone, it's different representatives, you know, from different parts of the bank in different countries, et cetera, where they had multiple workshops. They sat and kind of go, as APSA, what is it that we can own, you know, as a bank? What is our strategic advantage? They went through all of that. Now, what was interesting, and why we got picked, was that in our research, right, we went through a similar process, and we arrived at a similar place to where the whole bank had arrived from strategically. So from our research and their research, we were kind of saying the same things, right? And if you saw the outputs from their teams, right, So your story matters was actually in our pitch, although it was not, it was our strategy line. It wasn't necessarily our positioning line. So in our strategy, we said, you know, it's about your story mattering. That's how it was almost put, right? And when we married it with what they had done after we won the account, when we married it with what they had done, you know, we got to your story matters. So it was almost two worlds colliding at exactly the same time. So the ad that we released now, you know, the Your Story Matters ad, it was actually in our pitch. It was actually the pitch ad itself, you know. So it's always great to see that, you know, the work that we created in, because what normally happens is that once you get appointed, you restart everything, because then they say, this is what we were thinking. This was our thinking. Then you restart the work and you go with the client's thinking most of the time when you win a pitch. But in this instance, they went with the pitch work, right? What came out of the pitch. And that's how close we were to each other. So that's why the marriage worked from the first date.
Okay. That's actually, I won't lie, this sounds like we always talk about marriage is made in heaven.
Yeah.
From a corporate point of view, this actually sounds like one of those instances You know, where something like that comes together. But what are the challenges then, right? Because when you're working with a huge, you know, entity like that,
yeah.
SA Business, 12 different countries,
yeah.
You've got a retail bank, you've got a corporate and investment bank, you've got all of these different, yeah. I think they have a motor financing unit, you've yeah. got all of these different things happening. Yeah, maybe you could walk us through what that is like, right? Because, you know, when you talk to others who work with large corporates, there's a sense that large corporates can be intimidating,
yeah.
that communication lines can be federated, that, you know, you might be okay with one, you know, unit might be okay with yeah. this positioning, but, you know, you now have to consult yeah. with 16 others, because you did talk about the fact that there was an exercise through the yeah. bank to try and engage all the different yeah. units and countries. But now when you get appointed, right, yes. how is that?
Yes. So the minute we got appointed, we were told, okay, so now we need to get the positioning like spot on, right? So because they had started the internal processes and then we came in the middle of the ship, right now the agency coming in the middle of the ship, now because our appointment, now we are their lead agency, so there's other agencies too, but we are the main agency that integrates everyone, and we were now in a process where we are learning the bank at so firstly we've been inducted, we are learning the bank. But because they just came from a restructuring, everyone is new in the bank too. So they're also learning the bank. You know, everyone is in a process of learning, right? But culminating with that is you're probably launching the biggest thing that will happen to them for the next few years, right? So this plane is flying in the air and you kind of have to fix it as it's moving, right? And there's still everyday work that needs to happen. So there's the everyday work that happens, and then there's the campaign work that happens. Now, the only way that you can get that right is through good leadership, right? And I think the bank has invested in some good people within it, because then you are able to make good decisions very quickly if you've got good leaders and decisive leaders at the helm. And that's how we're able to navigate those challenges. Yes, the size of the bank is an extremely large institution, yes. But because the right frameworks, you know, they spend more time planning than executing, right? And that's where if you get the planning work done, right, the executions then become much easier, right? Because the planning work had started before our time and we came into a process that had already started and we just contributed and built on those plans, so that by the time you get to execution, I think we had the work that you are seeing now that was launched, I think was put, so last year was largely planning, you know, so we appointed last year around June. It was all planning. Up until December. And I would say that from the beginning of this year up until mid-Feb, that's when we're executing. Now, typically to execute work like that should take you about between 4 and 5 months. And it was executed in about 1.5 months, wow. Right? Because we spent so much time getting the craft right and planning.
Yeah. Okay. Now that sounds like quite an encouraging story. And I'm hoping that for anyone who's maybe starting out, especially, because we've actually had a number of conversations with smaller advertising agencies on this platform, particularly black ones. And, you know, through COVID and the recovery post that and the current economic downturn, the outlook hasn't been the best for some of those smaller players. So it is encouraging, you know, to have, you know, a symbol, a company, you know, like an avatar that, you know, some of the smaller guys can look at to say, actually, some of these things, some of these things are possible, right? If you do, you know, if you do stay the course.
We shall stay the course. You know, Mudio, you know, earlier when I said, you know, it's a glass ceiling that has been broken, it is not broken for us. It's broken for everyone, you know, because now means there aren't any more excuses. I mean, if I tell you the scale of, let's say, an APSA, there's over 1,400 billboards, right, that you have to create in the period of time that I spoke about, right? That is a lot, right? When you think about it, that the amount of assets that you have to produce, you need to be a well-oiled, slick machine, right? And, you know, speaking about the smaller agencies and where we were, the reason why we could get here is because we've spent a lot of time thinking about these things and learning from our mistakes, you know, and learning how to get it right, you know, from other agencies as well. So we know that we are in a position of responsibility as a business as well. You know, our actions are not just our own. They affect an entire industry.
Yeah. So when it comes to something like that, obviously, there are certain idiosyncrasies that come with running a creative business. But observing creative businesses and having dabbled myself, you sort of get the sense that there's more science to the art than we sometimes let on. Because I think sometimes when you think about creative businesses and that type of thing, you think about, you know, a bunch of guys wearing jeans and t-shirts sitting in a room and just dreaming up, you know, ideas, that type of thing. But there's a lot of strategy.
Yes.
There's a lot of number crunching, actually, you know, inside there. And in the world that we live in now, there's probably a lot of analytics that's going in there. So maybe you could give us a view of what it's like to run a creative business in 2024. And actually, maybe I should even ask the question, do you even consider Avatar to be a creative business?
So running a business like this, yes, there's a number crunching, strat, data. I think the famous saying is logic creating magic, right? And that's what we do as a business. But you know, running it in 2024, we are faced with very interesting challenges, right? And if I give a 2024 view, one, we've got a transformation problem now in 2024. It is very difficult, you know, to find good talent right now. It's black talent in particular. Not that it doesn't exist. It definitely does exist, right? But we could be in a far better place as an industry. And the problem is that this has been left, you know, as a problem, but there aren't any effective solutions that I've seen on the table. And it's very interesting that the guy that wrote a lot of the radio for APSA, he's a guy that came from Guatemala in the East Rand, in Springs. Guatemala in Springs. And he came fresh. He didn't go to advertising school.
Wow.
He came fresh. He trained with our people, right? And he asked to write a few scripts on APSA, which he did. Oh yes, and he eventually got a bursary with us, and we did send him to a school. But he asked to write a few scripts, and the client absolutely fell in love with them, those few scripts that he wrote. for apps. Now, this is raw talent. And I believe that, you know, there's a lot of that talent that is waiting to be discovered, but it just needs us to be more brave. Instead of saying it doesn't exist, you know, what we should be saying is, how do we get it? Because it does exist, right? We just haven't nurtured it, you know, when we give a 2024 view. Another thing in 2024 that is, you know, disrupting the way that we do business, right, is the advent of AI, right? And let me tell you how the APSA work was built, right? So in the pitch, the work was actually built using AI, right? Really? Yes. Wow. Yes, it was built using AI. So the images in pitch, they were all created using AI, the shots that we wanted, you know, because normally what you do is you go and find stock images, you know, and put in those images in the work, et cetera, et cetera, and the videos. Now everything was created with AI in the pitch, you know. Now, but that poses a very interesting problem, because then what does that mean for the modeling industry? Yeah. Right? What happens now? Because then I can recreate the same thing without a photographer, you know, and without an actual human being for a subscription, yeah. You know. And so what does it mean for an entire industry that exists, right? So the decision that, you know, we've taken is that we will use AI, right, as almost a blueprint of what we want to create, right? But we'll still use physical human beings and photographers, right? Because we've got a bigger responsibility as a business towards an entire industry and lots of people and professions and families, right? And that's the decision that we've taken, you know.
Can I challenge you on that point for a moment? Because, you know, when you look across the business landscape, the number of decisions that end up being financially based,
yes,
and not being in the human interest,
yes,
you know, are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
We hear so many different, case studies,
yes,
of businesses that have decided to cut costs, that have, yes, right? And I think right now in the world, Boeing is probably,
yeah,
one of the biggest examples. The cost cutting that they've taken through their supply chain has resulted in an aeroplane that is not trusted, right, around the world, and, you know, plane crashes that would not have, you know, needed to happen. So now when I come back and I stitch together your point about talent in the country and also where AI is, are we not reaching a stage where the number crunches are going to just push us into a world where people are just using AI? Mm-hmm. I look at what the likes of Midjourney have been able to do, OpenAI with DALL-E. I think OpenAI recently brought out Sora, their video creation platform. Input some words and it will create. And we usually talk about photorealistic, but this is realistic video, yeah, right? And in my head, I'm like, this is the worst that the technology will ever be. It's only going to get,
new.
Yeah, it's only going to get better from here. So I guess I'm sure it's a question that you've heard many times,
yeah,
to be like, how do you then protect,
yeah,
the industries? Obviously, you guys have taken the decision, but it doesn't mean that your competitors and, you know, other clients won't,
yeah,
take, you know, that particular stance. One, two, where does that fit into the agenda of trying to bring up talent,
yeah,
in the country?
Yeah. You know, what differentiates businesses is their values. You know, there's a story that I love so much. And apologies if I don't quote it correctly, but it inspires me so much. There was once a battleship, right? And whenever, You know, the army would go out with this battleship way back in the day. They would win every war that they fought, right? So the war ends, and then they decide they're going to use this ship as almost like a source of inspiration, that when everyone sees it, you know, it brings out pride within you, you know. And so they put this thing out for display, so it never goes out to sale now. So it's literally something that people just look at. And with time, this thing starts falling apart because, you know, it's not being maintained. It's just being baked in the sun, et cetera, et cetera. It starts falling apart, gets repaired over many, 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 many years, right? So then one day, then the question is asked, is it the same ship, right? Because all the wood has fallen apart, all the nails are original, they've fallen apart. It's been repaired so many times. Is it the same ship, you know? And the consensus was, yes, it's still the same ship because of what it stands for, its values, you know? And that's the importance of values. It's what you stand for as a business, right? Whether values align with different businesses, that's another story, you know, but it's what's important to us as a business. I mean, some of the decisions that we've made, I mean, I remember during COVID, we were meant to retrench people, but because of our values, we didn't, you know, we went against, you know, what the numbers were saying. Because of values, it's our values as a business, and our values have carried us to this place, you know. And had we gone the other direction, who knows if we'd be here or not, you know. But what I know is that from our perspective, you know, when you find a client that aligns with your values, so when we had this conversation, the client agreed, yes, we're going to use models, right? And that's because the values are aligning as agency and client. You know, whether my competitors will do it, you know, I can't speak on their behalf, you know, but you know, it's realizing that I realized this for myself a long time ago, in that for you to build a sustainable business in the country, it can't just be about capital, you know, because you will build a lot of capital, but if you feel unsafe driving home, there's a problem in that equation, yeah. Right? So we can complain all we like, but the question is, you know, as a business, what have you done? You know, like, what have you done to alleviate the social problems that exist in this country? You know, or are you part of them? You know, so you can make selfish decisions, make lots of money, you know, or you can be part of change, you know, but it all comes down to values at the end of the day.
Hmm. Okay. No, it is quite an interesting space to be in, because, like you said, sometimes the context within which people are doing business is more important than the business itself. And within the context of South Africa, there are many, you know, socioeconomic agendas, yeah, that need to be addressed.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to take, we're going to take the country forward, you can find a way to bring down costs using AI, but you're still saddled with a very high unemployment rate, yeah, in the country as, yeah, a whole.
And which could become worse because of my actions. That's the thing.
Yeah. Right. So one of the things I'm then wondering is, for people that are coming up in the industry now, because I think it's quite clear that AI is here. I'm having conversations about AI on this platform almost on a weekly basis now. Yeah. It was happening every couple of months, but I think since 2023, it's happening almost every week now. AI is like there, it's here to stay. Is to say, is there still a place for a person to learn some of the core skills? Copywriting,
yes.
Photography, videography,
yes.
Direction, production, idea conception, business analysis, all of those things.
Yeah.
Or are we in a space where a person must learn how to make the best use of AI?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're becoming quite philosophical here, but yeah.
My answer is a bit of a hybrid. AI still needs human input,
yeah.
Right? So you still have a human being that needs to use the tool. Just like if you are using Photoshop needs human input that needs to plant an idea for it to become a reality. It's just your methods of input are different, but you still need a human being on the other side, right? And AI can output whatever it likes, right? But you still need a human being for it to actually make sense, right? One. And I think when I say it's a hybrid, the advantage that we have, let's say as South Africans, right, is nuances, right? These tools are not built yet, right? There are certain things that it will be very hard for AI to get, right? Because they're built in Europe, America, etc., wherever the case might be. They work much better in that context than they do in our context in particular. And we are still a very, very long way off, right, till they actually get our context right. And quite frankly, you know, if you look at the South African economy versus the global economy, we are like 30-something, if I'm not mistaken, we're not very high on the food chain. So no one is prioritizing this market to get these tools right now, right? So that's why I think what we have is the benefit of time.
Okay, right? Benefit of time. Okay, yeah.
We have the benefit of time, right? But within that benefit of time, it allows us to learn, right? It allows us to learn and evolve. It means that if you're going to be a designer, you know, you need to have you can have the talent of design, right? But you also need to know how to use AI tools. We have the benefit of time, you know, for that learning cycle to happen. So I think it's an involvement. When you think about it, when TV was invented, everyone is saying it's the end of radio, right?
Yeah.
But here we are, they both coexisting together. And I think that's what's going to happen with these tools. They'll coexist together.
Okay. I like that point that you've just reached now. And I think maybe that's a place where we can end off today's discussion, is just around digital advertising and what it's doing to business. Before you and I started, you know, recording, we were talking about the existential crisis that, you know, our industry in terms of traditional media finds itself. Competition Commission having launched an entire probe into how the digital players have disrupted, you know, the industries out there. I think Viz Journalism did a study that by 2019, over 60% of all advertising revenue was going to just Google and Facebook in South Africa on their own. So I guess the question is, how does a business win in the digital environment? And I ask that because it sounds like you still believe in the more traditional platforms, because you mentioned that, you know, for Absa, for example, you guys had to create, right, assets for billboards, right? Which means part of the strategy is still on physical, you know, media such as billboards, right? But we keep hearing about the digital. How does a business win in this digital environment? Are there any businesses or industries that you think have done well? Because our industry doesn't seem to have done well in that regard. Yeah.
I believe that different platforms can coexist together because of consumer behavior. It's driven by consumer behavior more than anything. right? It's, for me, it's not about the platforms. It's about the human beings and what they do.
Yeah.
And it's about moving with the human being, right? Because as long as the human being wakes up in the morning and grabs the phone, right? The first thing they do, right? That's a platform. And after they do that, they catch up on the news for the day. And if they prefer to watch the news on a TV screen,
that's a platform. Yeah.
And when they get into their car and they switch on their radio, that is a platform, right? So it's the human being's behavior that is dictating the existence of platforms and not the other way around, right? So it's all about our behaviors. And because of our behaviors and as people, right, billboards are not going anywhere. The only change that is, you know, as long as we get into our cars and drive, they'll remain there, right? There will be more digital boards, but they remain boards. You know, the digital boards are cheaper because you don't have, you know, the cost of printing, as an example, versus a digital board where you just upload and you're done, right, as an example. So as long as our human behaviors remain consistent, those platforms are not going. That's why I say they can coexist. I mean, if I talk about your industry in particular, right?
Please do.
Google, all right, let's talk about it. I'll give you my opinions on it. Google wins because of aggregation. When you think about it, what gives Google power? It's the fact that I go to one place, right? And when I get to that one place, it connects me to many places. That's aggregation. That's the power of aggregation. And earlier we were talking about Spotify as an example. What has Spotify done is it's aggregated record companies together in a platform, you know, and that's what consumers want. They want places where information is aggregated and it makes sense, you know, in today's world. And those are the companies that are winning this war. The ones that, you know, and you think about, I mean, even to the simplest things like operating systems. Why did Nokia go down? Why? You know, it's because they said, look, we're not going to become part of Android. We will, you know, then we'll keep our Symbian OS. You know, it's our thing as Nokia. You know, and what was happening was there was aggregation going on with different manufacturers, et cetera, right? Now, in media, I think what is missing, it's because everything is siloed right now. You know, you've got your publishing house that owns a number of publications doing its own things. You've got another one doing its own thing, another one doing its own thing, right? And what's going to make the industry win as a whole is aggregation, right? So you need an aggregator, right? So an aggregator that the consumer pays a fee to, then the aggregator distributes that fee to the right publishing houses. But the benefit to the consumer is I can view whatever I want, and I don't have to constantly have 10 different subscriptions to view what I want. So if someone comes in with a solution and says you get one subscription and you view everything, right, now you've got a fighting chance.
So like DSTV, but for news.
Well, I don't know if they're the best example.
I don't know if they're the best example either.
You know,
maybe if I can say cable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cable.
Yeah, you know. We could argue Netflix. I think Netflix, you know, because now what they're doing is they're aggregating content from around the world, you know. So yes, DSTV or cable network started the trend, you know, but video on demand is now taking it cross borders, you know. And that's a form of aggregation of content.
Yeah.
And I think for South African publications to survive, that is exactly what needs to happen. You aggregate and you still make your money, because with aggregation, people tend to view the same. People love the idea of options, right? But it's not that they use all the options. Just like on your computer, when you go to your spreadsheet or your word processor, you use the same, you're probably using about 10% of what it's what it can actually do, you know what I mean, versus all the features, you know. And it's human psychology and behaviors. We do the same thing with our phones, et cetera, et cetera. And that naturally the same thing will happen. You know, if that fee is 200 Rand, that 200 Rand is probably going to go to the same publisher all the time. But the human being just loves the idea that if that one day I want to view something else, I can. You know what I mean? So everyone will still make their money. They'll make more money because then it will mean that a lot of the users that have fallen off due to, you know, the pay gates will come back to the sites, you know. And, you know, earlier we were talking about, I also think that in publishing, the model is wrong, you know, where the model of newspaper, physical newspapers is being taken to digital platform and there's a spray and pray and hope that it will work, you know. But what consumers are looking for is value. You know, you need to, advertisers need to provide value. You know, so it's about, so the advertising is in the value that you bring back to consumers. So if a brand comes in the journey of me viewing an article on your platform, right, that means a heck of a lot more than seeing a banner.
True, because they're actually seeing something that has actually been created for them. Or tailored, you know, towards whatever. Okay.
Yeah. But the role of the brand is being the key to unlock that. So yeah, I don't necessarily have to pay for it. The money that you would have spent on the banner, rather pay for me to view the article, right? Because I probably won't see the banner, right? But I will know that you enabled me. There is value that you've given me as the consumer. See, that means a heck of a lot more. I mean, when you think about it, propositions like the pointsman example with our load shedding, right? Look at the value that is being created by those pointsmen. You know, as an example, the brand value that's created, that does more than any billboard in my book. You know, so I can't speak about my own assets. I won't talk about those, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I see it from some of the properties that we part of. You know, it's all about creating meaningful experience, brand experiences for consumers. And for you guys to win as an industry, it's about working with advertisers and kind of going, how can we create meaningful experiences using your advertising money so that we can be sustainable?
Yeah, true.
And that's where the winning formula lies.
No, I certainly agree with you, and I think, you know, it's a good place to end. It's, for me, I think there's a disconnect of some sort, because obviously I'm in the world of finance,
yeah.
And there's this almost a symbiotic relationship that exists between the companies that we cover and media houses such as ours, because obviously we need their content and their advertising, but they need us to, you know, to report and spotlight what they are doing so that they can communicate to their shareholders. Their shareholders maybe might get a shareholder letter once or twice a year, but they might be keeping up, you know, through us, right? And if you have a collapsing, right, it's a systemic risk for them as well, because you end up having a situation where, I think this year they said at the World Economic Forum that misinformation, disinformation are two of the biggest risks that businesses need to be thinking about. And how do you protect against some of these things if the media that's meant to be representing you in some way is crumbling, and you have a juniorization, maybe people that don't fully understand your business reporting on you, or, you know, getting things wrong. I think it's a risk, and somehow these people, like what you've just said, they must meet,
yes,
and come together.
Indeed.
Mm. So that's where we end off today's discussion. It has really been a great one. Always a pleasure talking to Zibuzi. So I honestly could sit and talk to this man for a really long time. But it's been a good one. And What was quite fascinating was just sitting and getting the behind the scenes story of what it took to win APSA as a client. I think that was a big part of where we began the conversation and what we spent a lot of the conversation talking about, the fact that their place in the market as an independent black owned advertising agency, in some ways has been cemented by the winning of a piece of business like that. But the fact that once you win the business, that's where the real work actually begins, because he was talking to us about the planning, what it took to actually understand the nature and scope of an entity like that, and what it actually takes to work through some of those things. At least it sounds like there was alignment between where the business knew it needed to go versus what the research from an avatar side said the business should be going. So a good marriage from that point of view. Also talking about some of the challenges for the industry as a whole, whether you're a small player or a large player, some of the systemic things that are going on. And he highlighted talent as being one of the big ones, and AI as being some of the big things that people should be grappling with. And we actually went quite a bit into the weeds, just around how do we make sure that we're bringing up people's talents, but at the same time taking advantage and making use of things like AI. They've made a decision as a business that they can use AI as a tool, maybe for conception, that type of thing, but the final product, at least the case study gave us, APSA, they conceptualized using AI, but the finished products were all done using real people, because I think he said you have to be thinking beyond the capital. I think that's the word that he used. So that's where we end off. It has been a really great one. Thank you so much. We were in conversation with Zewuzi Sonkwanazi. He is co-founder and CEO over at Avatar Agency Group. Zewuzi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.